Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our topic tonight, disorders affecting the ears, nose, and throat. Runny noses, nasal congestion, headaches, and even fever are symptoms that many of us know all too well. When these symptoms are recent, they can be due to acute sinusitis. When these symptoms last 8 weeks or longer, it's called chronic sinusitis. Whether it's acute or chronic, sinusitis is painful and it can be disabling. It's common too. Every year it affects 37 million people in the U.S. and costs us $5.7 billion as a society. Tonight we welcome Dr. Brett Coder of the Arklatex Ear, Nose, and Throat and Hearing Center. We invite you to join our discussion. Please call us at 1-800-552-8502 or ask us a question via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our topic tonight, ear, nose, and throat disorders. And with us, we have Dr. Brett Coder with Arklatex Ear, Nose, and Throat and Hearing Center. Dr. Coder, welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Brewer.
So, runny nose, fever, congestion, difficulty breathing in general, how do you know if that's a cold or if that's sinusitis?
It can be difficult to tell initially. Folks just know they don't feel well. The only way you can tell definitively in patients sometimes would be to do cultures, which are not really practical. So we go more by clinical data, such as how long and their constellation of symptoms. And generally speaking, if you've had a cold-like illness more than 7 days, it's probably progressed on from a viral infection to a bacterial infection. And those patients would certainly be candidates for antibiotic therapy, certainly at that time. Whereas your family doctor may feel more like giving you symptomatic treatment rather than antibiotics in those first few days.
And so when you say symptomatic treatment, what sort of treatments are based on symptoms alone and not necessarily geared towards treating an infection of some sort?
A lot of this you can get over the counter, like decongestants, antihistamines, Tylenol, Advil, things like that. People even use spray decongestants. We don't recommend those long term, but they can actually give you pretty good relief initially in an acute episode.
And in an acute episode, what are the signs and symptoms that are indicative of a bacterial infection? You mentioned that most of the times this is due to a virus, right? The common cold virus.
Right.
What are the main symptoms of a bacterial infection or something that would actually need antibiotics? Because, you know, we hear people all the time, you know, I've been sick for 3 or 4 days. I'm really feeling yucky, so to speak. And they want to go to the doctor and get a prescription for an antibiotic. So what's a real indication for an antibiotic for a cold?
Again, if you feel it's a cold, then you typically wouldn't prescribe an antibiotic, though patients do feel like they're going to get better quicker with an antibiotic. And again, it's almost impossible to tell for sure. But a lot of it has to do with patients in terms of if they've had recurrent illnesses before this. If they have 5 or 6 episodes a year, then that's more likely episodes of sinusitis triggered by exposure to allergens, exposure to smoke, exposure to other contaminants in the air, rather than just the common cold. So when patients present with that type of history, I'd be more willing to treat them and try to clear that up with antibiotics as opposed to somebody that has the one cold a year type symptoms.
And so patients who actually have more problems with allergies are going to have more problems with infections?
Most definitely.
And why is that?
Well, the allergies cause swelling, and the swelling creates difficulty with drainage in the sinuses. And even though the sinuses are fairly large cavities, they have small drainage holes. And when they get swollen, they get kind of clogged, and it's easier for them to get infected that way.
So what are the sinuses for? What are they good for apart from getting clogged and swollen and being nuisances during the allergy season and during the winter?
Well, we feel like it acts as a resonance chamber for your speaking and for your talking. It acts as a safety chamber or a space between the outside of your head and your critical structure, your brain. It also acts to create mucus, which, believe it or not, you make a liter of mucus a day on average, and this will help to give moisture to your breathing, your airway. So it has multiple purposes.
Is there anything that we can do to maintain good health of our sinuses, those of us who don't suffer from allergies?
Maintain good health.
In terms of keeping our airways moist, I mean, a number of folks advocate for nasal sprays, maybe saline sprays,
right,
and things along those
right.
lines, and humidified breathing settings
saline is good. Saline's always good. I mean, a normal saline solution is going to help to promote drainage, promote passage of pathogens and things from the airway. We recommend saline irrigations, perhaps more aggressively than patients are aware. We don't recommend that they use a lot of over-the-counter sprays, however, because those can become addictive and cause rebound problems and actually make your breathing worse.
When you say over-the-counter sprays, which ones are you talking about, the ones that are quote-unquote addictive?
The decongestants like Afrin, neosinephrine. Those are problematic in that they cause rebound when they wear off. So you feel like you have to use it again to breathe again, and you end up getting in a vicious cycle of spraying, and it opens you up for a little bit. But then when it wears off, it swells up even bigger. So then you have to spray it again in order to breathe again. And that's common with long-term use.
And these aren't innocuous drugs, right? These are drugs that basically contract the blood vessels in the nose.
Correct.
And so they're going to be absorbed systemically, correct? And some of these drugs are actually going to increase the force of the contraction of the heart or increase the heart rate. So can there be medical complications from being overused?
Someone who's very sensitive needs to be careful with those sprays, as well as the oral decongestants that can cause sensitivity to increased heart rate, elevated blood pressure, that type of thing. So that's one of the reasons, like one of my favorites that can you use brand names on this?
You can.
Okay. I like Mucinex D. It's the regular strength Mucinex D allows you to adjust the dosage. If you take the maximum strength, then you're loaded to the max with the top dose. But if you take the regular dose, for some people, one tablet's enough. They get the benefit they look for, but they don't get that that buzz that keeps them up at night, or they don't get elevated heart rate or elevated blood pressure from it. So it allows you to adjust the dosage.
And so you mentioned the name of a drug, and a number of drugs, especially over-the-counter drugs, will advertise themselves as being an antihistamine or a decongestant or a combination of the two.
Right.
In terms of symptoms, what symptoms would lead one to go in the direction of an antihistamine versus what symptoms would lead one to go into the direction of a decongestant? Or what constellation of symptoms might one want a combination product?
That is a great question. And to help people try to differentiate what does what, the antihistamines are going to work more on your allergic reactions, which are typically going to be sneezing, itchy eyes, itchy nose, runny nose, that type of thing. So if your nose is runny and you have the itchy eyes, itchy throat, sneezing attacks, then you want an antihistamine, particularly if it's that time of year and you know you're allergic to those things. The decongestants, anything that says it's a blank D or Allegra D or anything D, they're typically talking about the decongestants there. That's more to open you up, and that's designed to open you up. Some of the compounds that are in the cold medicines are for cough. And then some of the compounds are designed to thin the mucus. So you have a constellation of different ones, and some of them may have all the above, where they have all four of those types of medications in there. And it can get quite confusing, and I notice that when I walk by the cold and flu aisle in the drug stores, you see people pondering and looking at their boxes and studying them appropriately. But I tend to recommend people, instead of getting combination drugs, that they get the one for the symptom that they're having, rather than taking too many medications that they don't really know they're taking sometimes. So if you're stopped up, take a decongestant. If you've got allergy symptoms, take an allergy pill with it. And if you want to take a combination of those two, that's fine. But when you start getting more than that, sometimes you start getting more medications than you know you're that you're taking.
Now, how does the treatment of symptoms from allergies differ from treatment of the symptoms of chronic sinusitis, or is the treatment in general the same, decongestants and antihistamines?
Well, people can start out with an allergy attack, and then it can evolve into a sinusitis, so they can overlap each other quite frequently. And so while you're treating a sinus episode in a patient, you frequently have to treat the allergies to help them in order to get better as well. Multiple levels of treating allergy. You can treat it medically. You can even have them tested and put them on immunotherapy as a long-term treatment. But more acutely, when the patient presents, you're going to go with medical management usually. And that opens up a whole different area of using nasal steroids and in addition to the antihistamines.
Okay, thank you very much. Again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our topic tonight, conditions affecting the ears, nose, and throat, in particularly upper respiratory infections. We have Pamela from Houghton Holding. Pamela, thanks for calling us on Health Matters.
Hello. My question is actually about the sinuses and Wegeners. My brother thought he had sinus infection and sinusitis for a really long time, and it turned out that he actually had Wegener's granulomatosis. And I knew someone else that went through like the same thing, and I was wondering if there was any way to differentiate it earlier before it's done so much damage and when it can be treated sooner.
So you're talking about the condition known as Wegener's granulomatosis, Dr. Coder. What do you think about that?
Well, it's an inflammatory condition that can cause a lot of damage in the airway and in addition to other organ systems as well.
Right.
We see that not commonly, and it certainly wouldn't be the first thing that your family doctor or even an ENT would think about when a patient presented. But if they have some telltale signs of ulcers or bleeding or irritation that's more than you would expect with a common sinusitis or a cold type of situation, that would prompt you to consider doing biopsies, which is how you're going to make the definitive diagnosis, or with some of the blood tests that you can do for Wegener's.
Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Coder, whenever you mention, you know, allergy symptoms, right now we're in the summertime. You know, we don't think about pollen being a big problem right now, but you and I were talking before the show that you're still seeing a lot of allergies. Why is that?
Well, people just tend to, unfortunately, go through the wintertime, and they're getting hit with the cold of the week, and then they hit springtime, and then they get the allergy blast, and then they're still suffering from that, or they may have persistent allergies related to the grasses that are still growing and putting out pollen, or they may have indoor allergies from dust and such as that that just is unrelenting for them. So those folks sometimes, they end up getting in the revolving door where they get sick and they just have difficulty getting better.
So there are some individuals where there is not really an allergy season. It's basically a way of life for them?
For some folks, depending upon how sensitive they are, they can have the allergies to things that are seen year-round indoors, in addition to the seasonal things that we see with the flowers and the blooms. And so they have the additional burden of dealing with that as well.
We mentioned earlier talking about the function of the sinuses and keeping the airways moist. And you also mentioned cigarette smoking. How does that come into play when people have difficulties with acute sinusitis or upper respiratory infections? And they may mention that cigarette smoking may actually help them to feel better whenever they're suffering some of these symptoms. What do you say when you hear patients say that?
I don't totally agree with them. The smoke is a direct irritant to the airway, and it's not truly an allergy per se, but it causes a lot of irritation, a lot of inflammatory response. And depending upon the individual, just like some people have allergies worse than others, some people will respond more dramatically to the smoke than others. I've seen patients who have polyps, for instance, which is a severe reaction in the nose associated with sinuses. From smoking, and you can take the polyps out, and if they keep smoking, the polyps will just come right back. So it's a known problem that we deal with on a regular basis.
A polyp, what is a polyp? You mentioned it in the nose, so it's a nasal polyp. Tell us a little bit more about what a polyp is.
That's a good question, and not to be confused with the kind of polyps that you hear about in people's GI tracts, which can be kind of scary sometimes. A polyp is typically it's due to inflammation. It's a sac of swelling tissue in the nasal cavity or in within the sinuses. It can contain fluid. It can contain a gelatinous material. But just to have to think about it as like a swollen sac of swollen tissue that has come up because of severe inflammation in the nose.
All right, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and our guest tonight is Dr. Brett Coder from Arklatek's Ear, Nose, and Throat and the Hearing Center. We have an anonymous caller from Shreveport calling. The question is posted on the internet. What does Dr. Coder think about neti pots?
We like neti pots. In terms of it's another form of saline irrigation, I personally prefer the same company makes a bottle that you can use to irrigate with. And so it's easier. You don't have to tilt your head and you don't feel like you're doing the waterboard treatment, that type of thing, like you can if you're using the neti pot the wrong way. So I usually recommend my patients to use the bottle rather than the pot. And you have to always be careful to counsel them to make sure that they use either distilled water, sterile water, or previously boiled water if it's come from the tap, because you can, and people have, unfortunately, in this state, gotten brain parasites from using untreated tap water.
Make sure it's treated water.
Right.
We have another caller. We have Cindy from Rusk. Cindy, what's your question?
I've had chronic sinusitis for 2.5 months now. I was seeing my primary doctor, and she put me on some Cipro, and that wasn't effective. And then I was put on some Bactrim and ended up having an allergic reaction going to the hospital for that. I'm out of that, but she did an MRI, and it showed the sinusitis. I finally got in to see an ENT, and they did a CT on me and said that I have sinusitis and deviated septum. And I'm doing everything they said, the Mucinex, the saline rinses, and the Flonase,
right,
and the Electra, and I'm not getting any better. I'm just, every night it's painful, and it's fever, and I don't know what else to do.
Have they put you on another antibiotic?
They were afraid to put me on another antibiotic since I had the reaction.
Okay. I mean, you can choose a different class is why I was asking if they decided to treat you with another class of antibiotics. If you're still symptomatic after what we would consider a maximal treatment, meaning you've run the course of anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks of antibiotics or the maximum you could tolerate, you could be considered for some of the surgical options. Did they mention any of those to you?
The only thing she mentioned was going in and fixing my deviated septum.
Okay. Well, with that, if you had sinuses that were clogged and weren't draining, there are some options you could do to try to improve the drainage of the sinuses. And if the patient's acutely infected at the time of surgery, you can even get a culture, make sure you've got them on the right antibiotics, so it can help you to pick what you need.
Okay. So possibly a culture. Is there anything besides fixing my deviated septum to get it to drain?
Well, you can, and it's not draining. Right. Well, that's what I mean is the surgery would help you with the drainage, meaning surgery to the selected sinuses, not having your CT here. We don't know which ones are involved, but, you know, depending upon the sinuses that are involved, you may need surgical drainage of those sinuses. And there's a lot of different ways you can achieve that. Some treatments now are even available in the office.
That sounds like it might help. I'm just trying to get the mucus to drain, and it's just not working. So,
well, Cindy, thank you so much for calling us on Health Matters.
I appreciate it.
Okay. So chronic persistent sinusitis, and you mentioned there are surgical approaches. You look at a CAT scan to see which sinuses may be involved. So what is the surgical planning in terms of someone who has chronic persistent sinusitis? When would you decide to go to surgery? I think you may have spoken a little bit about that. And how would you decide what type of operation to do?
Typically, the patient that's classic for sinus surgery would be someone who the patient would come and tell me they're sick of being sick. They've been on too many antibiotics. They've been on at least 3 to 6 weeks. CAT scan shows persistent changes within the sinuses themselves. And then your surgery would be tailored to what you see on the CAT scan in terms of which sinuses need to be drained or which sinuses don't necessarily need to be drained. And like I say, there's different techniques for the different sinuses. But the patient, again, will tell you that they're sick of being sick, and you tailor it to what they need in terms of what their symptoms are and whether or not they need their septum fixed or not. That's dependent upon whether they're having nasal obstructive symptoms with a deviated septum or whether or not you need to move the septum in order to gain access, because we do most of our work endoscopically now. So to gain access to the sinuses, sometimes you have to correct a deviated septum.
And so you mentioned nasal obstruction and fixing a deviated septum. Is that a potential cause for chronic sinusitis? Is that a situation that lends itself to predisposing patients who may have allergies or colds?
Absolutely.
To become
absolutely. Commonly you'll see a deviated septum with a spur or a point on that septum that's pointed toward one of the maxillary sides. And because they have decreased outflow on that side, the patient has difficulty clearing that sinus. So they classically can have sinus disease more on that side than they would on the opposite side. But you can see it on both. But the deviated septum certainly can contribute to their overall disease, as well as making the sinuses worse.
If someone goes to their physician and they're diagnosed with a deviated septum, do they need to have that fixed right away if they're otherwise asymptomatic?
Not necessarily. There are a lot of people walking around with deviated septums, and that's totally normal, totally fine. No one's septum is flat like a board or like your tabletop. You can have a little curvature going one way or the other. Again, it's going to be someone who's going to present to you with definite nasal obstructive symptoms, or because you're doing an access or procedure and you need to get in that side, that you may want to fix that septum.
And you mentioned you look at the sinuses and determine which sinus that you're going to operate on. Tell us a little bit about what sinuses are involved commonly. I know there are the frontal sinuses,
right.
There are the maxillary sinuses, there are other various sinuses,
right.
in the cranium or the skull.
Right.
Where are the sinuses? You know, why are they named what they're named, and what are the symptoms when you have sinusitis in one sinus versus another?
Well, they're named because of they decided to name the bone that. The frontals are up in your forehead. The maxillaries are in your cheekbones. The ethmoids are situated between your eyes, and the sphenoids are in the back behind the ethmoids. So you have four sets of sinuses, one on each side. And some sinuses are what we call hypoplastic, meaning they didn't grow very much on some people. But generally speaking, people have about eight sets of sinuses. And that doesn't mean that when you operate on them that all eight sinuses need to be operated on. The general course that we see, and just because of exposure up in the front of the nose first, is that you'll see disease in the ethmoids, maxillaries, and the frontals, less often in the sphenoids.
And when patients have facial pain as a result of sinusitis, is that typically one particular sinus versus another, or headaches related to one sinus versus another, or how can the doctor tell?
It can be. It can also be very tricky. What I mean is trying to discern a patient's pain pattern and attribute it to one sinus. Frequently, patients will come in with a pain pattern on one side, you do a scan, and it actually shows there's something going on the other side. So frequently the cause of sinusitis being the cause of your headache may be a little bit overblown, certainly by the drug companies that want to sell you Sinaid, sign off all these medications for all your headaches. But frequently we can tell if a patient has a particular pattern or a headache coming from a certain area, and if their sinus disease matches the distribution from that.
You know, we see a lot of patients with headaches. It's one of the most common, you know, conditions that patients come to see a doctor for. And typically a physician will order a CAT scan just to make sure that there's, you know, not a significant intracranial reason for the person to have a headache, which
right.
is extremely rare. As you know, brain tumors in
right.
general do not cause headaches. But CAT scans are very sensitive, right?
Right.
In showing fluid in the sinuses.
Right.
So how often do you see that? How often is chronic sinusitis a reason for someone to have chronic headaches without some of these other symptoms like a stuffy nose, runny nose, or other upper respiratory symptoms?
That's a good question. That's a great question. We see a lot of patients who are referred for headache and don't have sinus symptoms, and they may have a little polyp or something that's shown up in one sinus. And again, you can typically tell if it's related because they have headaches on the right side, but the polyp's on the left side. And those are the ones that you tell them, well, it's just a coincidental finding. It's not causing your problem, and you don't need surgery for that. Other hand, you can find some few patients that have significant enough disease, and they end up needing surgery. And if you do surgery on them, they're very thankful for it. But in terms of headache being a symptom of sinusitis, they actually have done a number of studies and actually have shown that the headache is more of a minor symptom of chronic sinusitis rather than a major symptom. So it's very tricky, very difficult sometimes to pinpoint exactly where your headaches are coming from. But I would say that it's certainly overplayed that sinusitis is a major cause of headache. Not to say it never does.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and we are discussing ear, nose, and throat conditions with Dr. Brett Coder from Arklatex Ear, Nose, and Throat and Hearing Center. We have a caller from Doyleen, John from Doyleen. John, what's your question?
My question is, I'm using a medication that the primary ingredient is fexofenadine. Am I causing myself harm by using it in trying to control? I'm on blood pressure medication, maintenance medication. Are they working against each other or causing me harm?
No, sir. Your fexofenadine is an antihistamine, and that will dry your nose. It will help you with allergy-type symptoms, itchy eyes, itchy throat, sneezing, but it should not cause you difficulty with your blood pressure.
Okay, and then ryegrass pollen seems to be my worst allergen,
mm-hmm.
and that is why I'm using the fexofenadine.
And you're getting good results with that?
Yes, sir. Very good results.
Okay. Then it sounds like you're on the way with that one.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
John, thank you so much for calling Health Matters. We have another caller from Shreveport, Karen. Karen, what's your question?
Hi. I was diagnosed with positional vertigo, and I get episodes where I have severe dizziness, and I would like to know from Dr. Coder, what can I do to prevent these episodes from occurring?
How were you diagnosed with positional vertigo, if you don't mind me asking?
It was actually from an ENT doctor.
Okay. And which ear did they tell you was causing your positional vertigo?
My left ear.
Your left ear.
Right. So when I lie on my left side,
right.
I'll get the dizziness.
You get the symptoms. Did you do the exercises?
Yes.
You did?
Yes,
I sure did. I'm sorry?
Right. But I was just curious what to do, like, to keep it from happening. I'm not sure what brings it on. It just happens.
Well, theoretically, you understand the pathology of what they think is going on there, right?
Yes.
You got the little rocks loose in your head?
Right, exactly.
Okay. You get these little microscopic grains of sand that are floating around inside your inner ear, and when you move your head just right or wrong, as the case may be, it stimulates the inner ear to make you feel like you're moving more than you really are. And the concept of those exercises is to move those rocks to a place where they won't bother you anymore. Now, it's not like you have one or two. You may have 50 of them, okay, or whatever, a bunch of them. And so if you're still symptomatic, it may be that you haven't moved all of them where they would leave you alone, so to speak. So you may need to just repeat the exercises.
Okay.
Is that making sense?
Sure, absolutely.
Now, you can have more stones, quote, fall off. I mean, you realize these stones are natural occurring in your inner ear that referred to as otoconia, and they can fall off from repeated trauma and that type of thing. But generally speaking, most patients, if you do the exercises properly, meaning there's a very specific sequence that you need to go in and do these exercises in order to move these rocks where they won't bother you, So if you do the right ear and the right exercise and the right sequence, then you'll have a 95% plus cure rate.
Okay. So is there anything that I can do to prevent the episodes from occurring? It seems like sometimes it happens if I get a head cold, and then other times it'll just happen out of the blue, and I don't know what I'm doing to cause, the little rocks to get in the wrong place.
Are you on that left side when the symptoms come on? Can it come on any time?
No, I always feel it when I'm on my left side.
Okay.
So I just need to avoid lying on my left side. I mean, is that what you think brings it on?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a,
okay.
If my point is that if it always happens to you on that left side, we just may not have moved all those rocks where they need to be yet.
Okay.
And so maybe we need to do some more exercises to move those rocks, out of the way.
Right.
And
it'll go away for, sometimes months. And
okay.
Then, it happens again.
Right.
And,
Well, again, so you can have more fall off. And so
okay.
that's a possibility. But most folks don't have it recurrently, meaning, over and over and over again. They can have it a couple times or a few times, mm-hmm. but I haven't seen many that it keeps coming back, very frequently.
Okay. So I think it's happened to me about four times.
Wow.
Over the past several years, four, five, 6 years. And it's once I learned the exercises, it's never been as severe as
right.
got the one time that was so awful. But I didn't know if there was something that I don't like ride roller coasters. I don't jump merry-go-rounds
right,
and those
right.
kind of things. And, I was just curious if there was something else because I just don't know. Sometimes I just kind of roll over on my side and there it is.
Well, the other thing is that if you keep having recurrent symptoms, it would be to investigate for other causes.
Okay.
So that may be something that could find something else for you.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'll do that. I'll get a follow-up appointment made.
Thank you so much, Karen, for calling Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502. Our guest tonight is Dr. Brett Coder with Arklatex Ear, Nose, and Throat and Hearing Center. So, Dr. Coder, we were talking about vertigo.
Yes.
And you got pretty technical pretty quickly, and so let's back up a little bit.
Okay.
And what is vertigo? And I think you mentioned the term benign positional vertigo.
Right.
So let's back up and say, let's figure out what is vertigo and what about this particular type of vertigo made it benign and made it positional.
Sure. Let's back up even a little further, if you don't mind, because we see a lot of people that come in and they complain of dizziness. And so dizziness can be any number of different symptoms. And so that's the key when I take a history from a patient for their dizziness is trying to discern whether or not their symptoms are pointing more to their inner ear or other systems. Vertigo per se, and I'm talking from an ENT very technically, that we kind of define that as a sensation of abnormal movement, even though you're not moving. And people who've had it, they know what I mean. You get that spinning sensation typically. It can make you very nauseated. These patients who have it bad can be very, very sick. They can be very ill. The benign positional vertigo that we were talking about is probably the most common cause of dizziness. Or vertigo, and it's been recently within the last 20 years, I guess, the doctor out in Denver decided to create some maneuvers to move some rocks around within the inner ear, and it amazingly does take care of the symptoms for, if you can diagnose the problematic ear, you can get good symptom relief in at least 95% of them if you do the exercises properly.
So it's benign because it's not due to something that's not benign, which
Correct.
Would be like a tumor or a stroke and things along those lines.
Correct.
So what types of vertigo or what types of dizziness would our callers need to be alerted to that could be not benign or something that's more severe like a stroke or a tumor or an infection?
Right. That's getting more in the neurology realm, but what those patients are going to see are more, like you say, is symptoms of a stroke where they'll have unilateral weakness of their extremities, slurred speech, altered mental status, you know, those types of symptoms associated with the sense of disorientation or unsteadiness. Frequently, patients can have poor gait and or disorientation because of a stroke. So typically the patients with the dizziness, they have their whereabouts. They know what's going on, but they're just very sick and very unable to maintain normal body posture.
And what about maybe ringing in the ears or hearing loss at the same time? Would that be an issue as well?
Yeah, definitely. In terms of an ear etiology, it's very common that you can have labyrinthitis or Meniere's disease manifest with sudden hearing loss, pressure in the ear associated with the ringing or the tinnitus in the ear. Some patients describe it as a roaring sound or pressure in the ear. And then you can also have the dizziness associated with that.
So would it be safe to say that any sort of unexplained persistent symptom of vertigo or dizziness certainly needs some sort of an investigation initially?
Yes, definitely.
We have another caller. We have Stephanie from Shreveport. Stephanie, thanks for calling Health Matters tonight. What's your question?
Well, my question was about the same. It was wondering what are some of the main causes of vertigo and how is it treated?
Main causes of vertigo. Well, again, the main cause that we see probably most frequently would be the benign positional vertigo. And luckily, we have pretty good cure rate with the exercises for that. Unfortunately, if you have some inner ear problems like Meniere's disease or labyrinthitis, and labyrinthitis is a fancy term for a viral infection that's gotten into the inner ear and it causes hearing loss and dizziness associated with it. When you're dealing with those issues, you're dealing more with nerve damage in the inner ear, and unfortunately, we don't have as good a prognosis for that for patients as you do with the BPV. The patients who have the Meniere's, the patients who have labyrinthitis, those are the ones that you have to treat medically in order to try to basically cover the symptoms, reduce the symptoms, reduce the reaction to the symptoms. And the beautiful thing about those types of problems is that your brain has the ability to adapt to these abnormal signals that are being sent by your inner ear to your brain, and it has the ability to adapt, and eventually you do get better. But for some patients, it takes longer than others. Unfortunately, the geriatric population has more difficulty because they have not so good vision. They don't have the same muscle strength that they used to have. And they also have cataracts, so they can't see as well, or they had cataract surgery and they can't see as well. And so you add up to these, and you don't get the normal inputs from these systems into your brain to help you to recalibrate, so to speak.
Stephanie, thank you so much for calling Health Matters on Red River Radio. We have Marion from Leesville. Marion, thanks for calling Health Matters.
Yes, my name is Marion, and I've been sick since since March. It started out with lightheadedness, kind of woozy. Then my ears popped, and I have a funny sound in my ears, and I couldn't feel stuff pouring in the back of my throat, and it haven't let up 24/7 ever since March.
Dr. Coder, those are a lot of symptoms. What do you think?
Yeah, we have a not uncommon symptom complex reported by Miss Marion. That may be a Eustachian tube problem you're dealing with Ms. Marion, but if it's mainly, like we were saying, mainly lightheadedness, that may not be inner ear related. So that's the thing. It may be related to something else. So you may want to check with your family doctor and see if they can find something else.
Marion, thank you so much for calling Health Matters on Red River Radio. Again, our number here is 1-800-552-8502. With us tonight, we have Dr. Brett Coder with Arklatex Ear, Nose, and Throat and Hearing Center. Dr. Coder, we were talking earlier about chronic sinusitis, and that's a serious problem in individuals who have repeated attacks of allergies throughout the year. One of the callers was mentioning the symptoms were so severe that surgery was actually recommended or being considered. Right. You mentioned that there's endoscopic sinus surgery that's currently available, but there are new procedures as well. What are some of the new procedures that have come out in lieu of functional endoscopic sinus surgery?
The latest buzz is around being able to do some procedures for folks in the office. as opposed to taking them to the operating room and having to put them asleep and do, quote, formal sinus surgery. It's actually an older technology. It's been around about 10 years or so, but the buzz is being able to do it in the office and finding that it actually has good results. And what we're talking about is the balloon sinuplasty procedure. Like I say, it's actually a technology that's been around. We've been using it in the OR for a number of years. And lately we have found that patients can have this done on selected sinuses in the office with relative ease, relative pain control, and fairly quick recovery post-operatively as well.
So relative ease, good pain control, quick recovery. What's a normal recovery process like with functional endoscopic sinus surgery compared to the newer technique?
Well, the endoscopic sinus patient, I typically go through questioning with them about what they do for their livelihood. And what I mean by that is if you work at a desk job and you're in a nice, clean, and air-conditioned environment, you could potentially be back to work within a few days to a week after endoscopic sinus surgery. Whereas if you're in a more exertional job or an environment that has a lot of dust, chemicals, and smoke and that type of thing, sometimes they need to be out of work anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks in order to allow the sinuses to heal in properly. Because if they go back into that environment with a freshly opened up and operated on sinus, it can swell up, it can bleed, it can cause more problems for them. Whereas the balloon procedure, on the other hand, again, that's outpatient. You do it in the office. It's under local. The patient's not asleep per se. And typically they can go back to most work within a day or two.
And so the balloon procedure, is it taking over, so to speak? Is it becoming much more common than the standard functional endoscopic sinus surgery?
It is becoming more common. It's becoming more frequent. I think a viable option as a first step for a lot of patients with what I would refer to as mild to moderate disease. And what I mean by that is, again, you'd have to look at the CAT scan to see for severity and other things like, do they have a deviated septum and can you gain access in the office? But, you know, for those patients with mild to moderate disease, it certainly could be a viable first option that may save them a trip to the operating room.
Absolutely. We have another question. We have Celeste from Lovelady, Texas. Celeste, thanks for calling Health Matters.
Sure. My question is, if you have recurrent sinusitis that you feel like that always starts with an allergy-type infection,
right?
At what point, or is there a point at which you should pursue allergy testing?
Great question. I typically tell my patients the time to consider allergy testing would be when you don't feel you're getting adequate control with medical management.
Okay.
And so can you tell me what meds you've been on?
I can't tell you right now. I know I had 4 infections last year, and I managed to get through 2 of them without. I don't like to take antibiotics because I have problems with yeast overgrowth.
Right.
And so I try not to take any. But
you'd like to control your allergies better so you don't get sick all the time.
Right, right.
Okay.
I mean, I work in a school system, and the minute summer's over and I go back to school and get around the kids, I'll either get a cold or it's
right
for the hay fever and all
right.
that kind of stuff, and then here I go.
That's all in the game for you because they're all out at that time of the year.
Right.
In terms of controlling your allergies, what I would suggest you might want to consider would be, especially during that time of the year, a good over-the-counter antihistamine, though they do make antihistamine sprays you can use. A nasal steroid spray would probably be a baseline medication to try for you to see if you could try to maintain better openings, better breathing, better drainage of your sinuses, even though your allergies are still there.
Okay, so start during allergy season, because I go to a PA and he told me to stay on them all year long, and I felt like that was a little bit too much, because then it seems like when allergy season starts, it's not kicking in anything. It's already I'm already on something. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the way that medicine works, you can use it year round, and it's safe to use year round.
Okay.
But if it sometimes for some patients, it can cause some irritation in the nose, a little bleeding, that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
And if you find you're having difficulty with it, then you may want to stop it during the time when you know that you don't have problems.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks, Celeste, so much for calling Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502. The next caller is Hill from Manny. Thanks for calling.
Hi. In 2012, I spent several months in the outdoors in an area that has aerosol gypsum calcium sulfate in it. It's a very fine dust that you can't really see, but it's there. And in my early 70s, for the first time in my life, I developed very severe allergies, and they've stayed with me now for 2 years. Is it possible that breathing that irritant for that many months might have contributed to this?
Most definitely. I mean, there's a lot of environmental things from on the job that can cause irritation in the nose, and a lot of it we don't even know, to be honest with you. What I mean is in terms of things that you even could come in contact with from different job to different job or different environment that can cause irritation to the nose. And again, it can also react real bad on you, but not, say, on me. And so you can get a variability in terms of people's reaction to that. But there's no doubt an environmental component to a lot of our sinus symptoms.
Well, I mean, I'm allergic even to cold air. It's not like some new pollen around. If I get too close to an air conditioner, then
right,
I wind up with the histamine response and all kinds of nose and sneezing and everything.
Well, that may be a vasomotor response, which you're talking about, when you get around cold.
Yeah.
And so there's actually a medication, a spray for that.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What's the name of it?
Atrovent.
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 Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay, great.
Hill, thank you so much for calling Health Matters on Red River Radio.
Thank you.
Our next caller is Chloe from Shreveport. Chloe, thanks for calling Health Matters.
Thank you. I was calling because I have constant ringing in my ears. I have tinnitus. I've seen an ear, nose, and throat physician and had my eardrum drained twice, and it's not getting any better. I haven't really been given many more options. Do I have any other options that you can think of, or am I just supposed to live like this?
Well, when they investigated your ringing, did they do a hearing test?
Yes, they did.
And did they tell you that you had any hearing loss?
Yes, they did.
And did they tell you that that was the cause for your ringing?
No, they did not.
Okay. But you said you had a hole in the eardrum or a tube, or did I hear that?
They said they were going to drain my eardrum.
Okay.
Puncture my eardrum and try to relieve some of the pressure.
Okay. That actually could be a separate type of problem. What I mean is the need to drain your eardrum may not necessarily address the tinnitus is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Unless you had fluid or something going on in your ear at the time. But, yeah, the most common cause of tinnitus that patients have will be due to nerve damage from their hearing loss. And, unfortunately, there is no magic cure for that. The best thing you can do for a lot of folks is to make sure they're not doing things that can aggravate it more, okay? And that is you need to avoid caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, and aspirin, okay?
Okay.
Now, if you take aspirin for your heart, obviously it's more important to protect your heart than it is to worry about the ringing in your ear.
Right.
But we don't recommend you take additional aspirin. And if you're drinking a lot of caffeinated beverages, a lot of folks can cut back on that and find that that can help them. If you're not doing any of those bad things that can make ringing worse, sometimes just knowing that it's coming from the hearing, the nerve damage in your ear is good because sometimes stress can make it worse. But unfortunately, there's not a, quote, cure for everybody. There are a number of medications you can try, but they don't work on everybody. But one of the more promising ones, I don't know if you've ever heard of, I call it lipoflavonoid. It's a vitamin complex that you can buy over the counter in the drugstore. And they do have some evidence that they can help, okay? And that's something that you can do on your own or try. And it's relatively safe because it's mostly B complex vitamins. And but if you're still having difficulty with the tinnitus, there are other things that can be done, and you just need to get hooked up with a good audiology group that has, for instance, if you had hearing loss and needed a hearing aid, there's different types of hearing aids that they can fit for you that can help to, quote, mask the tinnitus. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there are other treatments that can be done.
Okay.
Chloe, okay. Thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight on Red River Radio. Our number thank here is 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Brett Coder with Arklatex Ear, Nose, and Throat and Hearing Center is with us tonight. We have Gerald from Shreveport calling. Gerald, what's your question? Okay, maybe we lost Gerald. So we were talking about tinnitus, and that's ringing in the ears.
Yes.
And also the caller mentioned fluid in the middle ear. What is the middle ear, and what does fluid have to do with it?
The middle ear is the space behind your eardrum, and it most common cause for that would be eustachian tube problems. And we see that very commonly in children after repeated infections, less commonly in adults. But believe it or not, we do see a fair number of adults with similar problems, and some of them even need tubes like the kids. If you've got fluid in the ear, it can be a source for tinnitus, and that's usually relieved when you drain the fluid. But the more common scenario will be somebody who has nerve damage, hearing loss, nerve damage, and that will cause the persistent tinnitus that a lot of people are, frankly, frustrated with.
And the eustachian tubes, you mentioned eustachian tube dysfunction leads to fluid behind the middle ear.
Right.
What are the biggest causes of eustachian tube dysfunction?
In adults, actually, it turns out it's sinusitis.
Sinusitis, yeah.
Whereas in children, it's going to be just because of their anatomy and daycare syndromes, that type of thing, repeated illnesses, repeated upper respiratory infections. And then they have that shorter, flatter eustachian tube that is more easily inflamed and therefore not working properly.
We have Joe from Shreveport. Joe, what's your question?
Yes, hi. My girlfriend tells me that I have chronic bad breath, and I brush my teeth a lot. I even brush my tongue, but she says that the smell comes out of my nose. Sometimes when I sneeze, I can actually smell a bad smell from my sneeze. Could that be a sinus infection?
Certainly could be. It could also be a sign of something going on outside the sinuses, but in the nasal pharynx. It sounds like you may want to have that checked. You may want to have some antibiotic treatment for sinus disease, and if not cleared up, then you may need a CAT scan and an endoscopy to make sure that there's not something, quote, bad in the nasal pharynx or nasal cavity that could be causing that odor as well.
So even if this has been going on for 10 years, it still could be something significant.
Well, if it's been going on, you obviously have stood the test of time. The most common thing then would be like a purulent drainage or a sinus problem.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for calling. We have another caller from Ville Platte. Jim, thanks for calling Health Matters.
Hello?
Jim, thanks for calling Health Matters on Red River Radio. What's your question?
The question is, I suffer almost nightly. I wake up at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning with this post-nasal drip, and it's sort of real thick, and it to the point where I gag and I cough and I try to get rid of it, but the only relief I have is a gargle with salt water, warm salt water, and but that doesn't do any good. It can last until the morning, and it's getting to the point where it's almost nightly.
Sir, when you get this drainage, do you get anything that you produce or spit up?
No.
Okay.
I spit up just a little bit, but it just keeps draining and draining.
Okay. That certainly could be a sinus issue, but another possibility, just something to consider, is that it's not uncommon that we have patients who complain of, quote, drainage in their throat, cough, they have to clear mucus from their throat, they can have some hoarseness occasionally, they can feel like there's a lump in their throat, and that's due to GE reflux. And so when you mention at nighttime, that's the most common time when that would happen, when you would lie down And then you don't even realize, but you got some acid coming up and it's irritating the back of your throat. And that's what creates that drainage.
GE being gastroesophageal.
Right.
Exactly. Like heartburn symptoms.
Right. Yeah. So we commonly in our field, meaning ENT, we'll see patients who come in thinking they've got sinus drainage. And we'll do the full workup, look at them, scope them, CAT scan them, and everything's clear. And then it's probably reflux. And a lot of them, they look at me funny when I tell them it's probably reflux. And they don't believe me until they go home and then they take the medicine for a while and then they get better.
I do take something for acid reflux.
Okay. So you have a reflux problem.
Yes, I do.
It just may not be well controlled. Have you got the head of your bed elevated?
Yeah.
Okay. You're watching what you eat. You don't eat before bedtime, those types of things.
I try not to.
Okay. Be a little better with that now.
Yeah.
Jim, thanks so much for calling Health Matters on Red River Radio.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You know, we have a couple of questions that were submitted online we'll try to get to before we end the hour. One question we had was an individual had stopped smoking. Derek from Bossier, congratulations, he stopped smoking.
Yes.
But in lieu of smoking, he's chewing tobacco. And was wanting to know, were there any consequences regarding chewing tobacco, perhaps related to sinusitis or respiratory concerns?
Not so much for sinus so much as you still have the cancer risk from the tobacco products. The best way to quit that one would be to use the chewing gum, in my mind, because it's an oral stimulation and you're still going to get the nicotine. So you're not going to feel that withdrawal difficulty. So I'd recommend trying some. They have all different types and flavors now that even taste pretty good.
So we know that chewing tobacco causes mouth cancer, just
right.
Like you know, smoking causes lung cancer as well as a lot of other aerodigestive tract cancers. If someone is a tobacco chewer, how can they monitor for the development of precancerous lesions? Is there anything that they can do to check and see if they're getting cancer?
Yeah, it's not the easiest thing to check yourself, way up underneath your tongue and the back of your throat and that type of thing. So a good screening, a good ENT screening. If nothing else, your family physician can do a good screening. We obviously are always on the recommendation to stamp out the tobacco.
The other question we had was Gregory from Shreveport wrote in, I've heard that HPV can cause mouth cancer. What is it and how would you know if you have it? As you know, HPV is the human papillomavirus.
Right.
It's the virus that causes cervical cancer. So that's a good question. Can it cause mouth cancer as
Definitely.
Well?
Definitely. There's been some research over the last few years that have shown a definite connection there. And in terms of how do you know if you have it? The most common manifestation I've seen in patients is you get a little outbreak of papilloma, usually on the back of the palate, commonly around your uvula, the hanging down thing. And so it looks like a little cluster of grapes back there, and that's easily removed. I don't know that definitely cures you of it because it can recur once you've been had the virus. So, but in terms of whether or not it can cause throat cancer, it's probably the most common source in patients who don't smoke.
Thank you so much, Dr. Coder. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a health professional or a physician. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided by Wally Derleth, Daniel Gordy, Laura Moran, and Henry Edwards. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.